Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
Welcome to the Social Network Show. This is Dr. J, and Jim Nico is with me. How are you doing, Jim?
Really good, thank you.
And we're very eager to talk to our guests today. We have with us Tina Meyer from the Megan Meyer Foundation, mother of Megan Meyer, and later we'll be talking with Nina Burley. She is a journalist in New York and has been on the show a couple times before. So getting to our first guest, one of the earliest teen tragedies related to cyber harassment to hit the headlines was the self-inflicted death of 13-year-old Megan Meyer in suburban St. Louis, Missouri, in October 2006. She had been deliberately fooled into believing that a cute boy was getting to know her on MySpace, the social network, when in reality it was a hoax planned by the mother of one of her friends, a neighbor just doors away. When this non-existent boy suddenly turned against her, she was so distraught that she hanged herself. In the years since then, Megan's mother, Tina, has created the MeganMeyerFoundation.org. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Tina.
Thank you both for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, could you tell us about the mission of the foundation?
Sure. The mission of the foundation is to bring awareness, education, and promote positive change to children, parents, and educators in response to the issues surrounding bullying and cyberbullying in our children's daily environment. And when I look back, and it feels like it was a lifetime ago that we created mm-hmm. that mission, mm-hmm. I look back and it still truly holds perfectly true today, because we realize that you can bring awareness, but then you also have to educate. And then when you educate, you hopefully have positive change. And we need to also make sure you can't just educate students. You also have to educate the parents and the educators, because we all have to work together as a community as a whole to work on this. And that's where we really see that's where we're going to start making change, when we all come together and work towards this.
That is absolutely true. I noticed that same thing coming up in our work over and over again, that it's a very multifaceted problem. And
right.
There's many different ways of approaching it, and we need all of them at work. And we have spoken with and will be speaking with attorneys, and it's very interesting to me to read about the law angle of things. And I know that legislation is something that you worked on early on in Missouri. Could you kind of tell us a little bit about that, you know, why that was necessary and what transpired?
Sure. You know, after the tragedy with Megan, the FBI did investigate this case fully. And unfortunately, in the state of Missouri, we did not have laws. They looked at harassment and stalking and child endangerment, but nothing included electronic communication or cyberbullying. When Megan's case really became national and international news, it started getting the spotlight of Missouri, and we wanted to change the laws. We wanted to make sure that another family, if this did happen, another family did not go through the situation, that somebody would be prosecuted. And again, we realize that we don't want to prosecute every single person that says that they don't like somebody. But when they mm-hmm. get behind technology and they repeatedly threaten another person, when they repeatedly harass and make fun and spread rumors, when they repeatedly stalk another person, these are things that we can't tolerate in our world. And so in the state of Missouri, I worked with the governor for the state of Missouri at the time, Matt Blunt. He had an internet task force, and I worked with them. And in the year of 2008, August, they amended the harassment law and the stalking law to include electronic communications. So in our state, it can be a juvenile and also an adult. If somebody uses electronic communications to repeatedly threaten, annoy, harass, stalk another person, they can be charged. Many other states have followed. Some use the word cyberbullying and describe that. Some use electronic communications. But at the end of the day, you know, states are catching on. And in the end, we don't want every child to be prosecuted. We want to make sure that people that cross that line and that threshold do understand that these truly can turn into tragedies. And we have to make sure that people understand that the same way that they understand that it's against the law to drink and drive, it's against the law to steal, it's also against the law to truly harass another person.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it is something that's very important to me, but I realize the bigger picture is really the education and the change, and doing that on a daily basis every day is what's really going to help with this, our whole entire issue that we're dealing with bullying and cyberbullying.
Thank you. That is something that I wonder about on a federal level, too. You said the FBI was involved. Is there any indication that federal statutes are applicable?
Well, you know, Linda Sanchez in California did actually try to put out some federal legislation several times. And, you know, once you get onto the federal level, first of all, it's very hard to get laws changed to bring up new laws or to amend existing laws. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. And especially when you're talking about the First Amendment right.
Mm-hmm.
So that has been a big issue. I know that when they've brought it before, many people felt that they were overreaching, that we're stepping on that First Amendment right, that people have rights to their opinions, their likes, their dislikes. And so where do you stop that line of, well, was it an opinion or is it really truly intentional? What was the intent of it?
Mm-hmm.
And so you can read so deeply into this that any law that you look at, there can be some way to maneuver around it. At the end of the day, we want to make sure that it's consistent across the United States, that at the end of the day, people don't truly understand unless they've been there or have a family member. When you're dealing especially with children now who their brains are not completely developed until their mid-20s, they're trying to do everything that they can do to fit in because being a part of the group, social group within school is everything to them. And when they are excluded or they are now videotaped or they are now getting a group of kids who keep sending things out and pictures around, these children take these cell phones and their computers with them 24 hours a day. There's not a place for them to walk away from it. And so it is constantly being hit one time after another time after another time, and they start pulling back and feeling so isolated. And we want to make sure that these are things that kids know and adults know, that there is going to be a line. You know, you can have your opinions. You cannot like the way somebody looks. You cannot want to be friends with them or hang out with them. But to truly take vengeance out on them and do these things, it's not going to be tolerated. And that's where we have to really be headed. And I think, you know, it's not going to be fair for some versus others. But at the end of the day, we have to take a hard line so that people know to stay on the other side of that line, to not cross it, because it's not going to be worth it.
Tina, very articulate, very important what you just said. Want to mention to you Dr. Englander. We do the Elizabeth Englander series. She's working full-time on this issue, and she's very, very helpful, very cutting-edge for parents and educators. So just want to make you aware of her.
Wonderful.
And you can always listen to her show or spread the word, and we hope to collaborate and work with you further. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
From our website, thesocialnetworkstation.com, on the slider, the pictures that show up sliding across, she's on one of those. Well, going into the present now with the Megan Meyer Foundation, what are you working on currently?
You know, when all of this happened with Megan, I really wasn't sure what my next step was. I was trying to figure out, how do you wake up the next day and take care of my other daughter, and what are you supposed to do in this world now?
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that I wanted to help other kids, and I wanted to help other families, and I didn't know how to do that. And I actually went and spoke at a superintendent's conference in St. Louis, Missouri. And from that, schools started asking me to come and share Megan's story and the impact to get kids to understand. And it's kind of turned into this bigger-than-life foundation where now we do travel across the country. And I've been to 34 different states, and we've reached over 197,000 students, parents, and educators in live presentations. And so we do those programs. Those are extremely important because you're in front of parents and teachers and students to really share this. And it's not a sad story of, you know, I'm not bringing it to bring in this amount of grief. I've come in to share Megan's story, but it's really inspirational to, when we get to this other side, how can we change things? What can we do? And then we do a group where another program where we really sit down and talk in depth about what can they do in their own school and how do they make a change? And that's been phenomenal. We do workshops. We're working on new programs every day, but we also do a couple of fundraisers a year to help us with funding these programs. And one is a celebration for change. This will be our third annual one, and it's really a celebration of what the foundation is doing, how the public from around the United States is helping us do that daily. But we also give out scholarships to high school seniors from across the United States that have done something within their school or community to have created acceptance and difference and tolerance of others. Mm-hmm. And then we give some community awards for really some of the unsung heroes in the communities that really are on the ground every day, you know, helping people, but they're not in the limelight, and they're making a difference. And so it's really a phenomenal event. And again, it raises funds so that we can do more workshops and do a lot of the community outreach that we do throughout the country. And so we're really excited. That's going to be on April the 12th, and that's in St. Charles, Missouri, by our offices, and it's going to be a great night. So if any of the listeners are in the area or would like to come, that would be wonderful. We open arms to everybody.
Thank you. And in our next segment, let's talk more about the value of that face-to-face contact that you have with students and parents.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
What could make you eager for a trip to the dentist? Well, what if it meant a trip to Las Vegas? With USC training and 18 years of experience, your Las Vegas dentist is expert in fillings, root canals, crowns, veneers, implants, and clear braces. Dr. Naheed Mohammadi's office is easy to get to from the Las Vegas Strip. Dr. Mo strives for long-lasting solutions with quality materials and superb workmanship. Find her online at NevadaSunDental.com. To schedule, just dial your country's exit code. Often 00, then 1-702-898-0800. Whether you speak English, Spanish, or Farsi, you'll feel right at home, and of course, locals are welcome. 702-898-0800.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show. We are speaking with Tina Meyer, mother of Megan Meyer, founder of the MeganMeyerFoundation.org. And I'll just mention that Meyer is spelled M-E-I-E-R, so that you can find that easily. And during the break, we were talking about the many, many people who are working on affecting some change in society, in the media, in the laws, and so forth. And this is a multiple aspect of the efforts being put forth on Twitter, for example. Have you ever counted them up, Tina? How many people on Twitter are involved in anti-bully?
You know, I don't think I could take an entire day to count all of the different people that just have that passion to make a difference. Maybe it's giving an inspiring quote, or they just want to uplift other people, or the different professors and the different professionals that are out there doing it. It's, you know, and like I said to you during break with Dr. Englander, I would love to know more about her. We could have tomorrow 10,000 more people mm-hmm. in the United States that are just spread across different areas that really start specializing this and studying it and making a difference, and we still wouldn't have enough. That's how much of a need there is. So mm-hmm. we're always so thrilled and willing to collaborate and find out new theories and new techniques that work. At the end of the day, we all are wanting to work together for the same thing. We want to help children. We want to help the parents that are struggling. And we really want to help the educators that are in the classes every day dealing with this. And sometimes they don't have the knowledge, they don't have the time, and they don't have the ability to truly make that change. And so those are the things we all want to do every day. So working together and collaborating is the way it works.
That is great to hear, your willingness and desire to collaborate. You know, every once in a while you'll come across someone who's kind of wants to be the big fish in the small pond. And, well, it's more for their benefit than those that they're, purporting to help. But you're obviously interested in really making a difference.
And oh, yeah. I don't want to be just the only big fish, believe me. No, I like being with the other organizations so that we can all, again, collectively work together mm-hmm. and make a bigger impact. That's what we want at the end of the day. If we all work together, we make a bigger impact.
And what is encouraging to me is when I'm walking outside, every time I come to a curb that has been smoothed down for wheelchairs and for handicap, that to me is an encouragement, because I remember when there weren't things like that before the Americans with Disabilities Act, and I know that there's a lot of improvement to make in the way it's implemented and so forth, but just to see that makes me think, yes, progress is possible, even if it's in a small way like that, because it didn't used to be like that. There was no right. awareness of what the disabled needed. So I do think that we can effect a sea change, you might say. And the trouble is, it does come gradually, so sometimes you don't always feel like it's happening. But right. with the efforts, and so I promised that we were going to talk about the value of the face-to-face work. And when you're comparing talking to one school assembly or one group of parents at a time versus mass media communication and large organizations and so forth, sometimes it feels like your reach isn't that great. But I think that there is something that you accomplish with your one-on-one conversations. There's a picture on your website of you talking to a little girl who's looks troubled, you know. And what can really replace that one-on-one contact? Is that something that kind of keeps you going in this?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that if you're going to, and I don't like the word successful, because to me this was, you know, these organizations many times are started out of tragedy. Mm-hmm. You know, just like Carol Todd did with Amanda. It's out of tragedy, and it's out of really this drive of helping another. So it's not really successful. It's making it that impact. And in order to make a large impact, you do have to have a good relationship with media, because we do need to get it out on a larger scale. And that's very important. But the other really important thing is that one-to-one interaction and with those students. And when I go into schools, it's not that I can say anything truly different than what some of these teachers say. They will have, police officers come in that can give them true statistics. They can have juvenile judges come in. But at the end of the day, and they might even have shared Megan's story, the end of the day when the mom comes in, mm-hmm. somebody who's truly been impacted by it, and that person comes in and talks, they get it differently. It's more of, this is real, this is here. And for me, I know that I won't get to every single student, but my hope is that I get to the majority of them. But at the end of the day, I get to one student who is struggling, one student who is helping another friend that is struggling and they don't know what to do, or they know of somebody else, or it helps them down the road. That's what is so important. And, you know, many times I do encounter kids from when I get done with presentations that will come up, and, you know, they lay everything out. They will tell me that they've been attempting, that they're thinking about it, they've been cutting. Many times they don't want to tell parents or tell adults, especially parents, if they kids worry so much about what parents are going through, even though we don't think that they pay attention to a lot. Mm-hmm. They do. If they know that dad maybe lost his job, mm-hmm. they're worried and they don't want to put more pressure, or they don't want to get in trouble. If they know that there's a troubled relationship, mom's not feeling well, they feel like they're going to be a burden or it's not going to be okay. And so a lot of times they hold these things in. And that's something that's so essential and important that I talk to adults about, is we have, these kids know about this. They have the technology, they know about suicide. So what we need to do is arm them with, if you have ever felt this way, here's if I'm not available, and give them some names, give them some websites, give them and let them know that you are there, that you will help them. And it might not be perfect tomorrow, but that you can work together to get through, and give them some outreach. And we talk about a lot to parents to get it to click and remember, if we get into a car accident, your mind's not there. You're in this state of shock for a minute. You don't remember who your insurance company is, and you can't remember their name. So what do? You reach in the car, you get the card out, and you then have the information. We want that when a child is really struggling. We want them to have a piece of paper, a card, something that they've written down that's at home and with them, that has numbers of, if you're in trouble, who do you call? What's their number? How do you get a hold of them? Hotlines. And we want to make sure that children are equipped if they do start struggling.
Now, is this one of the resources that you mentioned about the needed resources for individuals in internet responsibility or actions to take when they're being bullied?
That's something, a lot of this is what I give to parents and talking to them about, really thinking about not do as I say, don't do as I do thing. Or, you know, we talk a lot about validating children's feelings, not their behaviors, not what, you know, the things that they've done, mm-hmm. but truly validating their feelings to get them to open up. But that's more of for parents. For kids, we talk a lot about a digital footprint. It's a new program that we're really working on to get kids to understand the impact of what they're doing and how that is then perceived on them, their whole entire, you know, their reputation. But what we do is we also have where we talk to kids about just the realities of the things that they're doing. At the end of the day, what I have found out from traveling across, you know, all of the different communities and different, you know, different cultures and differences, kids are all hurting the same. It doesn't matter the color of your skin. It doesn't matter how tall you are. It doesn't matter if you're a boy or a girl. It doesn't matter what you like. At the end of the day, we are hurt by something, whether it's from home, whether it's we're dealing with social rejection, we get hurt. And from that, we get angry and mad. And we want some sort of a resolution. We want to get somebody back. And from that, we can make really bad decisions. And kids impulsively just say what it's on. They get hurt. And then they get mad and they reach right back out. And so we try to get them to really understand, where is this pain coming from? Where does this hurt come from? And when they lash out, do they know what that other person is going through? And really, it's trying to instill empathy. It's trying to get them to think about walking in another person's shoes, because what they're going through too is a struggle. And so I really try to build that empathy in with them. But then I do give them basic steps of, if you are being cyberbullied, do not retaliate back. War of words never work. Mm-hmm. Make sure if it is a friend, take it offline. You know, call them. Hey, did you just say this? And see what their intention was. And if it was hurtful, you know, you handle it offline. Because if not, you create this huge ball of fire. Block the person. Make sure that you keep and save this evidence. Because if they continue to do it and it is a pattern, you need to make sure that you are able to show a pattern. If not, they can't, the police department, the schools, nobody can do anything if they just see something at this one instance. And then make sure if it's a threat to you, to a school, to another person, you screen capture that, you contact the authorities, you contact the school, and make sure you let an adult know. And never take those as just idle threats. We always have to take those seriously.
Well, thank you so much. That was a great rundown, you know, of the main points that you need to keep in mind. And I wanted to mention a couple other people that have we've run into. And when you talk about developing empathy, one of the shows we've had recently was with Dr. Maria Tatar from Harvard, who teaches folklore and mythology, and talking about the value of reading together from a young age and the value of stories, and talking about how different characters feel, that can actually be a way of building character and developing empathy.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and there's a fellow that's been emphasizing public and permanent. That's the name of his little book, and is a very dynamic speaker, Rich Gehry. And that is another just main theme that to hammer home, that what you put online, you have to be comfortable with the idea that that's going to be public and it's going to be permanent.
Or oh, absolutely.
Via your cell phone, too. Well, thank you so much, Tina Meyer of MeganMeyerFoundation.org. And you've given us some really good main points here. And also, we appreciate so much the hard work you've been doing, and that the tragic loss of your daughter has motivated you to share with other people in such a valuable way.
Well, thank you both for having me. I really appreciate it.
Want to be a guest on the Social Network Show? Email us at guest@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
This is Jim Nico on the Social Network Show, and we have some very important announcements here to make. Check out the next Jeffrey Sachs in Academics, Oxford University professor Linda Scott, Global Women's Empowerment, Economics, and Markets. Linda Scott at Oxford is doing wonderful things about women's empowerment. You can follow Linda Scott at www.doubleXeconomy.com. That's spelled D-O-U-B-L-E. Just the letter X, economy.com, in her upcoming conference at Oxford University in May 2014 on the topic of women in finance and entrepreneurship. You can also follow Linda Scott at Prof. Linda Scott on Twitter. Read info at Oxford site for conference and look at all the partners that we're putting together for this. And then here's another thing we want to mention again, Jonathan Salem Baskin's book, which is called Today in the Histories of Social Media. You can get that at Amazon.com, and you can follow Jonathan on Twitter. A next announcement, very, very important. We have joined with Danetta Campbell. I want to announce that we'll be interviewing the most innovative thinker and influencer we've met in high-impact social media. She helps corporate and brand messaging through these models in the next generation of CSR and thought leadership. You can learn about Danetta Campbell. I'm going to give you the name of her company. It's called thebarnyardgroup.com. And also you can follow Danetta. Once you type in her name on Twitter, you can follow her. There's going to be this live event. We're going to be talking about the Oxford event more. We're going to be having Professor Linda Scott herself on the show in February. We're also going to be talking more and more about Danetta Campbell. You can follow her on Twitter at DCBYGBounce. Please retweet her, because we're working on a very powerful project to empower women and girls around the world. Last but not least, we'd like to tell you about something that's coming up with us, and that is our 50-show initiative, where we are launching 50 shows for women and girls around the world to help bring women and girls to the level they really deserve in the world and even the playing field with men. Thank you very much. This is Jim Nico on The Social Network Show.
Now, back to The Social Network Show.
Welcome to The Social Network Show. Today we're speaking with Nina Burley, author of The Fatal Gift of Beauty. And we've talked with her about the ins and outs of the Amanda Knox trial, in which they use some material from the Facebook pages that were somewhat incriminating. That was a social network blooper. And something else that has come up through social network very rapidly this week was some fallout from the award granted to Woody Allen and the letter to the New York Times by his adopted daughter, Dylan Farrow. Nina, what's going on in that regard?
Well, just let's be accurate. Dylan Farrow is Mia's adopted daughter. She's not Woody's adopted daughter. He did not adopt her. People always make that clarification. So what's going on is that, these allegations of sexual abuse of Dylan Farrow were brought up in the early 90s when Woody and Mia broke up, and when Woody then went off with Mia's older adopted daughter, Soon Yi, who he is now married to. And these allegations were brought up in Connecticut, and a prosecutor there did announce that he felt there was enough evidence to charge, but he wasn't going to because he thought that the child was going to be emotionally damaged by a trial or a case, so he didn't. And then I believe they went to some kind of a committee law enforcement, where the law enforcement committee announced that they didn't find evidence. So it was all very muddy and unclear at the time. The girl was about 7 years old, and now we come, 20 years later, she's come forward with this letter detailing some really kind of disgusting behavior. And I wrote a column for the New York Observer about the reaction to that and the reaction to allegations that have been made about other very creative and well-known men like Roman Polanski, and then the way that the creative community in Hollywood responds to them. And basically my premise is that we as a society, it's not just Hollywood, but we as a society are really kind of enable these guys who have this predilection for younger women and young girls. And we enable them, by basically, watching, let's say, Woody Allen's movie with Mariel Hemingway was a love interest in one of the movies, and she was 16 years old or less, and she basically said, later, many years later, that her first kiss was with Woody Allen, and that she looks back on it as something that was really uncomfortable. And so what I wrote was that, we look at these things and from the view of the man, and then only after one of them comes forward do we then think, that's not right. Mm-hmm. Or try to see it from the point of view of the female or the young female. And in this case, of course, what she's alleging is a crime. It's child sex assault. And so, of course, there's a lot of, he's not guilty until proven guilty. He's innocent until proven guilty. I believe that he's writing a letter to the New York Times to respond.
Of course.
as is his right.
Well,
but it's interesting to watch the responses to this, because you do see this reaction, sort of a knee-jerk reaction among people to blame the girls in these mm-hmm. cases, to say, you're just doing that because he's a powerful man, or you're just doing that because somebody implanted a memory in you, and now, you can't you know, it didn't happen, but you were, you can't get it out of your mind because Mia Farrow manipulated you and so on. And, I just think, you know, in the broader sense, you know, the way that we look at our, look at these men, is, kind of telling about, the position of women and girls in society, and for us to immediately respond that, oh, she must be making it up because he's famous, really misses the point that is made by the statistic, which is that 97% of rapes go unreported. So you're down to 3% anyway. So this one person is out, is among 3% reported. And for us to, you know, have this knee-jerk reaction, which we do, you know, we do that with, let's say, the Kobe Bryant case, mm-hmm. right? The yeah. woman comes forward. Immediately, people are, you know, willing to believe that women do this, girls do this to, you know, go after a powerful man. Well, let's remember that they're humiliating themselves. They're putting themselves up for all kinds of contempt and abuse in public when you come forward with such a thing. What would the motive be?
Right. And in case anyone's wondering why we're into this topic, it's because raising women above the second class citizen status is on our agenda as the Social Network show. And in the case of abuse, women and children, spousal, child abuse, the power differential plays such a central role, just as it does in bullying. And hence the mm-hmm. term mm-hmm. cyber abuse is more often used in place of cyber bullying. And, you know, mm-hmm. Nina, I have a master's in social work, and I remember when I took a course in child sexual abuse was the first time I realized that it's par for the course. It's standard operating procedure for a family and their surrounding adults to rally round not the victim, but the perpetrator. That is, mm-hmm. by and large, the usual reaction to it. And, you know, people don't want to believe it, and mm-hmm. so they'll disbelieve the child. And it's... I think what this brings up is, and I've read Mia Farrow's memoir, When What Falls Away. I read that years ago, and I was reviewing it this week. And that's why my information from that is that he actually did, just before this revelation of these pictures with Sun Yi that incriminated him, that there was an adoption. He did adopt those three children. And she tried desperately to get it reversed at that mm-hmm. point. But okay. he was cut way too much slack long before this actually came out, because one of her comments was, although Woody's behavior with Dylan was not yet on course, I believed he would continue to work on it in good faith. They had professionals consulting with them, you know, counselors, psychotherapists, etc. He had been misbehaving with this child for months, if not years. But
wow.
It's what should our response be? You know, boycott his movies. I think if the person is still alive, unlike Michael Jackson, for instance, I think the evidence is pretty much in that he was indeed a pedophile. Also, what do you think? What should the appropriate response be?
I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, victim advocates would say boycott. Me personally, I went to see the movie, last summer, with Kate Blanchett, who's a wonderful actress, and I don't boycott his movies. I don't particularly like them, so I don't go to them all the time, but I did go to the one in the summer, and I found it really offensive. I found it offensively misogynistic. I thought that the Kate Blanchett character, especially at the end where, Alec Baldwin confesses that he's fallen for a younger woman and basically turfs her out on the street, mm-hmm. it was, you know, Kate Blanchett's breakdown on screen was Woody was directing her to channel Mia. That's the only thing I could think of when I saw that.
Yeah.
It was a powerful image and very, very offensive. And but then again, he's making art, right? And so you can't. People who make art, artists have, they have,
they get a
leeway and, he can make any kind of movie he wants and people can go to see it or not.
Well, that brings up the point.
I wouldn't say boycott his movies, but I personally don't find them particularly, inspiring or even that funny.
Yeah. And I think
one wasn't very funny. This is our society. I mean, let's go back to the other man that I mentioned in my column with J.D. Salinger, and there's been a documentary made about him recently, in which the woman who was the model for the female child character in a short story he wrote called For Esme, Love and Squalor, Esme, the model for Esme was this woman who was, at the time when he met her, 13 or 14, he met her on a beach, and he started writing her letters and communicating with her and taking her out for ice cream, and the parents were, of course, okay with it. Back then, there wasn't so much attention on this, and also they were very flattered. He's a famous author, and then finally she gets to be of age, and he takes her to a hotel in New York, and they sleep together, and the next morning he dumped her. And you just feel this, you get this sense of there are these men out there who revile adult women and have this preference for girls. And what the way I ended the column was reminding people that Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, which is so much a part of Woody Allen's shtick, right? Freud, when he was doing his research, interviewed all these or analyzed all of these women that he diagnosed as being hysterical or had been diagnosed as hysterical. And he kept getting the same eerie, creepy stories from them, which were these memories of childhood sexual abuse. And instead of making it his lifetime career to figure out what was up with the men who were doing this or alleged to be doing this to these girls, he basically threw up his hands and said, it's something internal in the women. And then, of course, his famous question about women, what do women want? Rather than focusing the spotlight and the investigation and the study onto what it is about men and masculinity that makes them behave this way towards young girls, right? And what is that pathology? And how common is it? So, unfortunately, I think even to this day, we live in such a man-centered culture and patriarchal culture that the people who are doing wrong are often perceived to be the victim.
Right. So true. Well, thank you so much, Nina, for taking some time out to talk with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.